It's actually a little overwhelming to look out and see so many, many dear friends. You know, it's almost 50 years now that Davy and I have been here, and we've known many of you for decades, and that connection, the friendships that we have, it's like there are bonds of love and friendship and seeking together and spiritual upliftment. All of that has tied us together, and it's as if our hearts are interwoven. Our hearts and minds and souls are interwoven with each other and connected. And just to look out, you only get to look at Davy and me. Unfortunate people. But we get to look out and see so many of you. It's really, as I say, it's quite overwhelming. We want to talk today. This week is going to be on the subject of the search for God and why it can't wait. We want to talk today about what is that search, and specifically why it can't wait. And in divvying this up, I got the part which, what is God and what is the search? And Davy's going to tell you why it can't wait. So there's a joke that probably many of you have heard about a Sunday school teacher who has told the students to draw a picture. And one little boy is very conscientiously working away, and she comes up and says, "What are you drawing, Johnny?" He says, "I'm drawing a picture of God." And the Sunday school teacher says, "Well, nobody knows what God looks like." And he says, "They will in a minute." So Michelangelo did that for many of us, you know, up there on the Sistine Chapel, that grim-looking old man and with the long flowing hair and the beard and reaching out to give life to Adam. And so many people have that kind of a concept for what God is. Or according to the culture you're in, you might have the concept of Shiva or Vishnu or Brahma or, I don't know, what other images are in people's minds. Well, hint, they're all wrong. Every one of them is wrong. On the other hand, every one of them is right. But every one of them, you know, the story of the blind brothers trying to describe what an elephant is like, and one has the trunk and says it's a snake, and the other has the tail and says it's a rope. One has the sides and says, "You're both crazy, it's a big wall." And another one has a hold of one leg and says, "You're all three nuts, it's a big post that comes up from the ground." So all of that's the elephant. Well, you multiply that times infinity, literally infinity, and that's what God is. He's everything. So Master says that at a certain point, the mind is simply not capable of even visualizing what God is. We can't get a grasp on infinity. The way he put it was this. He said that the typical person has, he put it as a thought each minute of the day. And so we have, you know, 1,000 thoughts a day. Over the lifetime of a person, we have 25 million thoughts. Now, these are not just the little passing ones. These are kind of major things that our mind has really grasped onto. He said, most people can't remember very much of anything. What did you eat a week ago for lunch? Can you remember? Probably not. You probably ate lunch, but he calls it the fog of delusion. And so the fog of delusion comes in. So A typical person might have 25 million thoughts during his lifetime. We can't remember those, but at the time of death, it's revealed to us. So there's a part of us that is aware of that. That part of us, the superconsciousness, is aware of all these things, but it's aware of just primarily us and what's been affected. Now, God is aware of every thought of every being, not just humans, on this one little mud ball in one tiny little galaxy in the universe. He's aware of every thought of every conscious, every sentient being in the past, in the present, in the future, all simultaneously. Now, our minds can't get around that. Master also said that in the church he was speaking in during this talk, he said, the lights that are shining, there are trillions of electrons that are moving in order to allow those lights to shine. And he said, God is conscious of every one of those electrons. He's conscious of every electron, every subatomic particle in all of creation. And so our minds, trying to grasp that concept of God, if we draw a picture or do a painting on a ceiling and say, I've got it, I'll show the others, you'll know in a minute what God looks like. It simply is not possible for the mind. Master put it this way, he said, the mind can take us so far, but as it approaches subtler realms, it's simply incapable of going there. And so we can't conceive of what God really is. So God helps us out in part by appearing in the form of great masters. Now, we have wonderful masters, God-knowing masters, but Master wasn't God. Or he was God in the sense that you're God and I'm God and the chair is God and this table is God. That one little body can't encompass infinity. But the difference between the masters, and Ananta said this so beautifully yesterday, the difference between the masters and us is that they are, it's not as if their body or their personality encompasses God, but they're aware of God, and they're aware of infinity. See, the mind can't grasp infinity, but the superconscious can grasp infinity. The mind is related, is attached to the ego, and the ego cannot grasp anything beyond finitehood. But our superconscious aspect, our intuition, our soul, can grasp, at least feel, at least connect with an aspect of God. And ultimately, we will leave even that behind, that soul nature in a sense, and merge completely with God. But so, if we're trying to talk about the search for God, then it's helpful to have a little bit of a goal in mind of what that is, where we're going. It's a little bit like if you don't know where you're going when you set out on a journey, you're very unlikely to get there. And so if we don't have any idea of what God is, we're very unlikely to get there. In fact, Master said that what the mind can do and is good for is to give us a concept of a goal that we're reaching for. So if God isn't a person or a place or a thing, then what is he? He's a state of consciousness. He's pure consciousness. But pure consciousness is not a concept our mind can get around either. But what Master did, and what the great masters of India have done, is they said that there is a state of consciousness that not only can we achieve, but everyone will at some time achieve, called samadhi. And so that state of consciousness of samadhi, at least for us, can be a kind of a stand-in for what we're searching for. So, you know, when we were going to take the pilgrim vows and the various vows of the monastic order later on this week, and so one of the vows says, I embrace as the only purpose of my life the search for God. So we could substitute here, I embrace as the only purpose of this life the search for samadhi. And that will give us at least a little bit of a clearer sense of a goal. Now, during the meditation at noon, we're going to play a recording of Swami reading the poem Samadhi. But many of you, most of you are familiar with it, but some of you aren't. And so I thought I'd read just a few lines from it so that we can get a sense of what it is that we're searching for. No, I think I'm okay. At least I'll fake it here. So this is the beginning of the poem Samadhi. Vanish the veils of light and shade, lifted every vapor of sorrow, sailed away all dawns of fleeting joy, gone the dim sensory mirage, love, hate, health, disease, life, death, perish these false shadows on the screen of duality, waves of laughter, scillas of sarcasm, melancholic whirlpools, melted in the vast sea of bliss, the storm of Maya stilled by magic wand of intuition deep. The universe, forgotten dream, subconsciously lurks, ready to invade my newly awakened memory divine. I live without the cosmic shadow, but it is not bereft of me. And so on. It's one of the great mystical writings of all time. In fact, Swamiji has said that in all of his reading and all of his knowledge, no one has ever captured in words that state so clearly as Master did here. And he suggested that you memorize that poem and repeat it each day. Partly it'll keep your memory fresh, which we need, since we can't remember what we had for lunch last week. But more importantly, it keeps clear in the mind the goal that we're searching for. You know, when Swami wrote the guidelines or the booklet about the Nyaswami order, the new renunciate order, what he said is almost the central point of that, is he said, in order to achieve this state, you have to renounce. You can't be attached, and I'll talk about that in a moment. You can't be too attached to the things of this world. But he said, in the past, renunciation has been world denying. I'm not supposed to do this. I'm not supposed to like that. I can't possess this. I'm a sinner, and I'll roll in some rose bushes so the thorns will penetrate my flesh. You know, that has been kind of, he said, even the color of the Swami order is orange, which represents a fire. And into that fire you cast all possessions, you cast all desires, you cast everything. So it's getting rid of, getting rid of, getting rid of. Obviously that's part of getting out of delusion and part of renunciation. But he didn't want, in this age, that to be the defining part of it. He wanted it to be samadhi-affirming, not world-denying. And that's why we wear the color blue, because in the spiritual eye, as you go into the state of samadhi, you go into the field of blue that you see in the spiritual eye. But so let's use as kind of our substitute for infinity, let's use to the best of our ability our concept of samadhi. So that's the goal that we're after, is we're all after, we're trying to achieve the ability to go into the state of samadhi. Now, to describe that process a little, we'll talk about it at much more depth tomorrow, but when we go into this state of feeling ourselves unified with everything, that's the natural state of our soul. And we achieve that state through the perceptive power of intuition, which is quite different from the mind. And I'll talk about that in a moment. But that intuition allows us to perceive ourselves, not to have the actual experience, not mentally, not through imagination, but the actual experience of being omnipresent in everything. And that happens automatically as soon as we fulfill certain conditions. The primary one is that the soul who has that is in that state already. Each one of us is truly a soul, not the body and personality that we see, but the soul is in that state already, but has chosen, partly as the cosmic drama, but has chosen to identify the sum total of our reality as this body and this personality. And so the soul in that state of cosmic delusion is the ego. That's how Master defined it. The soul identified with the body and personality is the ego. And so it isn't what we really are. It's like dreaming at night. You're a little character in your dream. Now that dream character is not who you really are. And in the morning you wake up and you can laugh at, maybe it was a dream of fright or a dream of terror. If you're in the dream and you think that's real, that goblin chasing you in the dream is very frightening. But if you're aware that you're dreaming, you kind of laugh at it. Well, the masters are aware that they're dreaming in this current reality, in the sense that the character in your dream is in a certain sense an extension of you, but only a tiny part of what you really are. And so it's not that you can say, well, that isn't me, it's a part of you. The problem comes in when you think that that character is the whole of who you are. And when you're caught in the dream, that's what you think. You have no reference outside of it. And so we don't have a reference outside of this current reality, except by mental kind of projection or imagination, but we don't yet have the experience of waking up, because if we did, then we would laugh at the things of life. And if we were dreaming, we would be lucid dreamers like the masters. And so master, a person who goes through the process, arrives at the ability to be in samadhi, nirvikalpa samadhi, meaning that you never leave that state. They're lucid dreamers. They do their part in this world. They do whatever is needed to be done, but they aren't deluded into thinking that this world or their body or their part is the totality, whereas almost everybody else on earth thinks that unless, by golly, I increase that portfolio of mine, I'm going to die broke. Oh, it's such a tragedy. The market is down today. It was down last week. I don't know what. And we get so immersed in the little drama that we forget our greater reality. Well, the whole of the spiritual path is to break that delusion. And so one of the things that India and the Vedic scriptures have that's unique among religions is that they have the concept that you can merge back into the Creator. Most of the Judeo-Christian and other religions that stem from that have the Creator as separate. We're the creation, and we're separate from the Creator. And perhaps you can go to heaven. Perhaps you can even sit on the right hand of God. Well, I guess that's Jesus' place, so we can sit on the left-hand side of God or sit at his table or something. But that's about it. Now imagine, now God is infinite and eternal. So imagine that you have arrived at the penultimate, the ultimate state, and that you're in heaven and you're sitting at God's table. About a week goes by, and you're still sitting at God's table. About 1,000 years go by, and you're still sitting there at God's table. You begin to look around and think, wonder if he's got a TV set. You know, that concept is not, it sounds good when you're really busy and you're in a hard climate in the desert, or it's cold and snowy, and you think of a vacation in Hawaii. You think, oh gosh, that's wonderful. But about 3 months into that, having no other things to do, it's not so wonderful. So the sense of moksha in the Vedic religion is that you can remove this delusion of separation and actually merge with the infinite, which is what the goal is. So that, and it doesn't come from somebody thinking this up. It comes from the actual experience of it. And Master said that he gave a talk called How Seekers First Found God. And he said basically it starts out that they realized that they were happy some of the time and unhappy other times. And they thought, well, this isn't quite fulfilling. Let me see if I can be happy all the time. And so that search to be happy all the time is what propels the search. And ultimately they realized that nothing that came to them from outside or came to them through the senses could keep them happy all the time. And so they thought, I can't seek my happiness outside of myself. I've got to seek it within myself. So they closed their eyes. And then gradually, by deeper and deeper states of concentration, and by allowing the mind and the emotions to become still, they began to perceive their inner reality. And so it goes on. I'm not going to give a summary of the whole talk, but you can see the process here. So what we're trying to do in our search for God, what is the search for God, is we're trying to get to that state. First of all, we define it as eternal happiness, but it's way, way beyond that. Because along with this concept of infinity that we go into in samadhi, the key, the absolute central aspect of samadhi is bliss. Bliss beyond compare. Eternal, ever new bliss, Master said. So God is defined as consciousness, awareness, existence, conscious awareness, and bliss. And when we go into the state of emergence with that, we have infinite existence, infinite consciousness, but most importantly, infinite bliss. And so That's what we're after. And moksha is moksha. It's delusion and the cutting of delusion. That's the meaning of it. And so moksha is one of the key concepts, which is that we cut delusion. And so the Bhagavad Gita, which many of us are familiar with, starts out with Arjuna, and it starts out, but after, with the blowing of the conches and some other things like that, naming of the warriors. But when the dialogue between Arjuna, representing the seeker, and Krishna, representing the self-realized master, when that begins, it basically begins with Arjuna saying, Krishna, I'm confused. I don't know what I'm supposed to do here. I'm supposed to fight, but I don't feel like fighting. What am I supposed to do? So it's delusion, it's confusion. And then throughout the dialogue of the Bhagavad Gita, Krishna begins to instruct Arjuna so that at the end, the very last exchange between Arjuna and Krishna, Krishna says, O Partha, that's Arjuna, have you received this wisdom with wholly uplifted consciousness? Has your delusion born ignorance, O Dhananjaya, now been dispelled? And Arjuna answered, my delusion has been demolished. I have, by your grace, O Krishna, regained the memory of my soul. I stand firm now, all my doubts and questions answered and dispersed. I will act according to your word. So that's the ending of the Gita. So the whole Gita is about moksha, delusion, the cutting of that delusion by wisdom, by the guru-disciple relationship, and ending in that soul now no longer being in delusion. That's our drama. That's for all of us. Swami called Arjuna devotee every man. So his drama is our drama. That's what we're after. But why can't we just sit down, say, okay, I want samadhi, and have it? You know, I mean, if that's all it is the cutting of delusion, why is it so hard? Well, when God created the world, he had to do it by duality. And so ignorance is the only way. Duality is the opposite of unity. So unity is samadhi merging our consciousness with God. Duality is thinking that we're separate. Well, in order for there to be a world, a planet, a solar system, a galaxy, a universe, there has to be duality all the way down to the protons and the electrons being oppositely charged in an atom and subatomic particles. And so the whole fabric depends upon duality. And so the mind, what we think of as our mind, our intellect, we think is going to lead us to freedom, lead us to samadhi. In fact, the mind can't do that. It is set up by its very nature in order to allow us to deal with this physical reality, which ultimately is delusion, but it's the delusion that we're caught in. And so the mind, the intellect that we think of as so wonderful is like our dream person's dreaming mind that holds him into the dream and allows him to function within that dream, but can't awaken him out of that dream. And so ultimately we have to get rid of the limitations of the mind. And I don't want to put it down because we couldn't function in this world. But it's set up so that it draws us into a state of delusion. One of the ways that it does this is that we think the mind allows us to perceive reality. It doesn't. It allows us to perceive only narrow slices of reality. And then built on those narrow slices, we build up the thought that this is what reality is, when in fact it isn't. You know, you've probably heard of what they used to call idiot savants, a person who has, now they just call them savants or special, I'm not sure what the proper terminology is now, but it's people that have extreme abilities. The Rain Man, if any of you saw that movie, Dustin Hoffman was a savant. He could, you tell him your birthday, he'd say, oh, that was a Saturday, that was a Monday, that was a Tuesday. He knew every flight of every airline of all the times. He knew everything. He had incredible memory, but he couldn't function very well in the world. It was very literal. Somebody once asked him if he knew Abraham Lincoln's Gettysburg Address. Now, the normal person being asked that might start out 67 years ago, but he told the address of the place that Lincoln stayed when he was in Gettysburg. And so, extreme abilities, but in a very limited, narrow way. Now, you can say, well, people are just born that way, right? Well, there are cases of traumatic savants where one man I read about fell and bumped his head, had a concussion, was in a coma for 2 or 3 days. When he awoke from that coma, he could play on the piano that he had never played before every song flawlessly that he had ever heard. So that ability was already there. But his normal functioning mind had said, if I release that ability, you're not going to be able to function very well in the world. You're going to be at the piano all the time playing everything, which he was obsessively. And so the mind is a limiting factor. It isn't a factor that gives us reality. And in fact, I just read that, you know, when in our teenage years, when we go into our teens, up until that time, our minds, our brains are function, and the structure of them is somewhat different. But for instance, we learn languages. If you learn multiple languages before you're 12 or 13, you speak them flawlessly without any accent. Afterwards, it's very hard. Why is that? Because at that time, the brain starts to narrow its function. So if you're in an English-speaking country, the part of the brain that works with words will get hardwired so that the signals can travel maybe 100 times as fast for the use of English. But at the same time, all of the other connections that have the possibility of speaking flawless Swahili and Bengali and Spanish and all of those, the brain actually gets rid of those connections. The brain begins to eat itself. I just read last week that scientists now are thinking that schizophrenia is caused by that same process gone amok, same as cancer is a natural process gone amok, where the brain begins to eat part of its prefrontal lobe and overdoes it. And that's what causes what we think of as schizophrenia. So at any rate, the point here being that the mind is a limiting factor. And in order to go into samadhi, we have to be out of our mind. Most people say that's a pejorative. Guy's out of his mind. I say, glory be. Because we have to get out of that limiting factor into our intuition. So that's like one veil. And the mind helps us function. It points us in the right direction, but it can't take us to the end of the goal. Then the second veil is the veil of our feelings and emotions. Our emotions get attached to things, the likes and the dislikes, the feeling nature. We have to have the feeling nature because we actually function more in the world through our feelings than we do through our intellect. You know, the animals, they don't have real strong intellects, but they function just fine, and it's more intuitively and with feeling. So, but Patanjali, he defines yoga or the state of samadhi. Let's use those interchangeably here. So he defines samadhi. Samadhi is the neutralization of the whirlpools of our likes and dislikes. Yogas chitra vritti nirod. Samadhi chitra vritti nirod is the neutralization of those whirlpools of feeling. As soon as we calm those and neutralize them, we don't have to go and learn anything. We simply are in this state of samadhi. It isn't something that we learn. It's already our natural state. And in fact, Patanjali goes on to say, when the seer is in this state, he rests in his own self. So when we're in samadhi, we rest in our own self, our own true self. At all other times, the next aphorism is, he is subject to the varieties, the vagaries of creation. And so we're thrown about by in the world of duality. And so going, the goal being the search, is the search to get into that state of samadhi, and we have to neutralize or calm the mind and neutralize the feelings. And tomorrow we're going to talk about Master's pathway of doing that. But finally, I want to say that there's one more kind of a veil that we work with. And that's the veil of, for lack of a better term, our involvement, our attachments, our actions in this world. And so when we begin to do something, our minds go there. Our hearts, our energy, our likes and dislikes go there. And it's as if we have a flashlight that is showing us just one little section in a vast warehouse. And that flashlight, because that's what we're interested in, all of our actions are done within that little flashlight area. And we're totally forgetful of all the other things that are going on. And so our actions, our life gets very tunnel visioned. And what we have to do in order to break that, what is it that makes it tunnel visioned? It's because those actions are done with the purpose of supporting the ego. Why do we go to work? Because we want to eat. Why do we want to eat? Because we want the body to stay alive, and so on. The body isn't us. You don't have to eat. I don't have to eat. We live on cosmic energy. We don't need food. But because delusion, moke, pushes us into thinking that we're the body and that the body needs externalized things in order to keep it alive, then we'll die if we don't eat. Not because we have to die, but because that's our mindset, that if we don't eat, we will die. And so you think it's true? All right, it's true. Sure, go ahead. You think you die? Then you die. But none of us ever dies. Master says that as soon as we're out of this body, we feel this enormous relief because we're out of the cage. See, the physical plane existence is the narrowest part of the levels of the created universe, and then God's beyond that too. And so once we're out of this body, we have an enormous sense of freedom. Unfortunately, we're probably going to come back to it. You know, a couple of years ago, they were doing the school awards, which are wonderful to go to. The teachers bring each student up and talk about that student and what they've accomplished this year. And one year, Narani, who was teaching first grade or second grade, she talked about the fact that they had a game that they played with the students called Big Self, Little Self. The little self was when you didn't want to share your toys, you teased other kids, you did whatever. Big self was when you wanted to share, you wanted to help, you cared about others. And so the students would say big self or little self for themselves or for the others. And one of the students came and said, you know, I can't even remember being in my little self. So that's what we're after. Only big self is not just sharing our toys. Big self is samadhi. And so when we finish off with this life, we're going to have the opportunity to have a life review. And if during that life review, we can say with absolute clarity, all I want is to be in my big self. All I want is unity with God. I don't want anything else. I'm done with all the rest. Then we actually, the energy, the life force leaves coming up. And if we have that, it bends at the medulla and goes to the spiritual eye and out through the spiritual eye. And we don't have to reincarnate. But if the little self says, you know, I wanted to be really, really rich. And I was only sort of rich. But I think I can do it next time. Or I want to be famous, or I want anything that has to do with the ego, then the life force leaves through the area of the medulla. And whatever that desire or desires, remember you've had 25 million thoughts during this lifetime alone, and maybe more than one or two were about little self-desires, right? If you leave with those predominant, then you get to come back. It isn't that you get punished. You just have self-decided that you want to play again. You want another ride on the game or another ride on the Ferris wheel. And you come back and we're here again. So our job, our search for God is the search to go into samadhi, to hold that state, and most especially to be able to hold it as we exit from this body. And that ends the cycle of birth and rebirth. And that's the search.
So as Jyotish said earlier, what I'm going to be sharing now is why the search can't wait. In one of Swami's delightful plays, The Jewel and the Lotus, there are two characters that are, two of the characters in the play, are kind of set up as juxtaposition with each other. One is the rich merchant, representing the materialistic consciousness, Romesh, and then his young son, the devotee, Narayan. And Ramesh is trying to convince Narayan to join him as his junior accountant in the business. And Narayan has no interest. He just wants to go and see God. And finally, there's the great line that we often quote where Ramesh says, "Look, son, can't you see I'm just trying to ensure your future happiness? The time to seek God is when you're old and have a little security and have nothing better to do." And the play is very, if you haven't had a chance to see it or listen to it, it's wonderful. Ramesh finally is converted and becomes a devotee. But this concept, when you have nothing better to do, that's sort of the epitome of how the materialistic consciousness looks at the search for God. Okay, you know, it's a nice hobby. Maybe when you're older, you can take up, you know, basket weaving or search for God or whatever it might be. Go to the senior citizen center and play bingo, search for God, you know. But the gray ones give us quite a different image, quite a different goal. They say, and this is a wonderful quote from Master, he said, "Don't say, tomorrow I will meditate longer. Tomorrow I will do this or I will do that." He said, "A year will go by and you will find you haven't done a thing. Rather say, this can wait and that can wait, but the search for God cannot wait." So why is it that the search for God cannot wait? Because obviously for many people, it's not even on their radar. They're perfectly happy doing what they are. But for us, for those who have tried to put God in first in their life, who have come together in spiritual groups, the search, there is an immediacy. An immediacy, and why is that? Well, first of all, as Jyotish was explaining with such depth and clarity, this world is not real. And we keep, Maya, the root of Maya is the measurer, that which divides the totality into little quantum pieces, little succinct units. And we keep thinking, each one of us, if I just arrange the pieces in a different way, it's going to work. And if I move here, or if I do that, or if I eliminate that person from my life, it's going to be great. I just know it. And yet, we keep moving the pieces. And because we're playing on the surface, it never makes a difference. Devaki's visiting us here from Seattle. She dramatized a wonderful story of Master, which I'll recount. She called it A Man Named John. But the way Master described it, once upon a time, there was a man who suffered from very poor health, and he prayed to God, "Oh, please, God, just give me, in my next life, give me good health." Boom. That life was over. He was reborn, robust body, able to do whatever he wanted. But he looked around him and he saw that there were people with a lot more money than he had that could go skiing and skydiving and rent a rocket to go into space. And he said, "Okay, in my next life," this one didn't quite work, "I want to be rich." So boom, that life was over. He came back. He had a good body, healthy, and he had lots of money. And he was just having a wonderful time. And then he realized, you know, I wish I had someone to share all this with. And he prayed to God, "Lord, in my next life, give me a life companion. Give me a wife." So that life unfolded and God gave him a wife. But such was the case. His wife was a terrible nag. And he was miserable. He had a strong body and all the money in the world. But this harpy that was always pestering him. And he said, "Lord, okay, this time I want to have a healthy body, a lot of money, a life companion, but make her nice." And so, boom, this lovely, next life, lovely bride comes into his life, idyllically happy. But such was her karma that she died at a young age. And said, okay, I didn't get that right. We better keep moving these pieces. Praise to God, health, wealth, life companion, sweet person, long life. Got it all. But unfortunately, she lived a little too long. And there she was, and she was old and feeble, and he kind of lost interest, and he started being attracted to his beautiful young secretary, and he ran off with the secretary who took all his money, and there he was at the end. He was a broken man, no health, no wealth, no life companion, nothing. And this time he said, Lord, I get it. All I want is you. And so we keep thinking, if only we could change it, if only they would listen to me, then the world would be okay. But you know what? I don't know your experience, my experience, they don't listen to you. They do what they darn well please. And the world goes on and on, on and on. And so we need to, the first immediacy is that we are playing with a house of cards. And no matter how many times we shuffle those cards, no matter what hand we get, when we start building that house of cards, there's no stability there. And then the second reason why there is an immediacy is that, you know, one of the great illnesses of our times is anxiety. Now, you can say, oh, yes, it's because life is so stressful and people have so much, there's so much input and so much information and technology. You know, we can look at it from a different way. I think it's wonderful that there's so many people with anxiety because they're seeing that this world is not going to give them what they want. Everyone has a certain sense of, you know, something's not right here. And some people let it become debilitating, but we should have a sense of anxiety because if we're really secure in this world, we're going to be bitterly disappointed. We think, oh, finally, I've got it all. But it's like little sugar crystals in water. We think, oh, that little sugar crystal, that's mine, and I'm happy, and it's perfect. But what happens? It just dissolves. And that which we reach out for no longer was within our grasp. And so there's this underlying sense of dis-ease, of unease, that, and you know, you look at the world around us today, and this anxiety and the rise of radicalism, fundamentalism, extreme conservatism, it's all a function of the advent of Dwapara Yuga, where it used to be really definable and people were comfortable. I'm a Democrat, I'm a Republican, everything was fine. But it's all now it's people are seeing there's something deeper and more real than that. There are real issues that are not going to be addressed by mere party affiliations, and that's making people very uneasy. And so they're shoring up, ossifying, making, I mean, if it wasn't so tragic, it would be comic, the political positions that people are taking. But it's really a function that people are starting to realize. This world is, it's so much more varied and subtle, and the perspectives are varied and valid. And how do you form a political party with that kind of understanding? How do you have a religious faith when you realize that all religions have a validity? Well, you come to self-realization, and that's the good news. But this sense of looking at the world and being in a state of uncomfortableness with it, instead of saying there's something wrong with me, we should say there's something very right with me, because I'm able to see that this world is trying to find security in this world is like building a house on shifting sands. I wanted to read a passage that illustrates this so beautifully from Autobiography of a Yogi. And, you know, this year, if you don't recall, when was this book written? Anybody remember? Came out 1946. So this is the 70th year since the publication of Autobiography of a Yogi. And with our a lot of our outreach and publicity this year, we're calling it, this is the year of autobiography of a yogi. So we're going to be referring to this a lot through everything we do this year. But this is a wonderful chapter that took me so long to understand, and I'm just scratching the surface. I have to just say, there's a dear friend of mine who's a 19-year-old who's in the Karma Yoga program right now. And I asked her if she's read autobiography, and she said, yeah, but I don't get very far in it because I'll read one chapter, and then I realize I didn't really get that chapter, and I read it again and again. Well, I'm with you, kid. That's how this book is for me. But anyway, this is from The Law of Miracles. Master says, one day I entered a motion picture house to view a newsreel of the European battlefields. World War I was still being waged in the West. The newsreel recorded the carnage with such realism that I left the theater with a troubled heart. Lord, I prayed, why dost thou permit such suffering? To my intense surprise, an instant answer came in the form of a vision of the actual European battlefields. The horror of the struggle, filled with the dead and dying, far surpassed in ferocity any representation of the newsreel. Look intently. A gentle voice spoke to my inner consciousness. You will see that these scenes, now being enacted in France, are nothing but a play of chiaroscuro. They are the cosmic motion picture, as real and as unreal as the theater newsreel you have just seen, a play within a play. My heart was still not comforted. The divine voice went on. Creation is light and shadow both, else no picture is possible. The good and evil of Maya must ever alternate in supremacy. If joy were ceaseless here in the world, would man ever seek another? Without suffering, he scarcely cares to recall he has forsaken his eternal home. Pain is a prod to remembrance. The way of escape is through wisdom. The tragedy of death is unreal. Those who shudder at it are like an ignorant actor who dies of fright on the stage when nothing more is fired at him than a blank cartridge. My sons are the children of light. They will not sleep forever in delusion. Although I had read scriptural accounts of Maya, they had not given me the deep insight that came with the personal visions and the accompanying words of consolation. One's values are profoundly changed when he is finally convinced that creation is only a motion picture and that not in it, but beyond it, lies his own reality. So that last sentence is very significant. One's values are profoundly changed when one realizes that our reality lies not in this world, but beyond it. And then we come again. Why the urgency? Because we know. Not everyone knows. Not everyone knows that this world is a delusion. But you would not be sitting here. You would not be walking this path of Kriya Yoga if on some perhaps remotest aspect of your being you did not know that our reality does not lie in this world. And so we have a responsibility to our own self to honor that innate understanding that we can't walk away from it. Other people can walk away from it. I'm sure we all have friends and family who say, what's the big deal? What's wrong with life? It's not so bad. Let them find it out in their own time, in their own way. But once you know, there is the unrelenting responsibility, the unrelenting drive. That's why Master loved the poem by Francis Thompson, The Hound of Heaven, where he describes God as forever in pursuit of the soul. And the soul tries to find happiness this way and that way, but the hound of heaven continues to pursue him. And so for all of us who have that spark of realization to whatever degree, and don't count yourself outside of that circle. You would not be here if you didn't have that, if there wasn't some part of you. So it's our that's why the urgency. We've come this far. We can't turn back. I remember the first winter I was here at Ananda, was the winter of 1970. And it was not an easy time. I was living in a little teepee, canvas teepee, without any heat, if you can imagine, snowing. I really didn't know many people. There weren't many people here. I was cold. I was lonely. I was not sure about many things. And there was some part of me that said, you know, you don't have to stay here. There's no chain on your leg. You could walk out the door tomorrow. But then there was some other part, and thank God, that part was what God let me honor, that said, go back. Go back to what you left. You know what's there. That's why you left it. And thank God I didn't. I just honored that responsibility of the effort I had made, the effort we all have made, not in this life, but many lives. And so that search, there is urgency. And what are the things that, what are the motivators that keep us going? Well, as we've been saying, one is suffering. We get burnt enough and we say, I don't want to suffer. I want to be happy. I want to find lasting happiness. I got a letter from a friend who lives here recently, and it touched me very much. He said, you know, I never thought a great deal of myself spiritually. I've made a lot of mistakes in my life and so forth. And I never thought I would be somebody who would find God. He said, but you know, I'm getting, the older I get, just so I don't have to go through this suffering anymore, I want to find God. And I was so proud of him because he got it. And he was speaking for all of us. The past lives of all men are dark with many stains, but all things in future will improve if we make the right spiritual effort now. So to go on and say, I want to be happy, whatever it takes, and this motivates us. Another motivation is, as we were saying, the innate wisdom of the soul seeking truth. And you look and you look in all around you, everywhere you can look except God, and you say, it's the jnana yogic path, not this, not that, please not that. And you just say, but what's true? What in this world is true? And the only thing, no matter how many different places we go and try to find it, is the truth of the consciousness of God. Everything else is water through our fingers. And so our soul's innate yearning for the truth of this, of our own being and of the world around us. And, you know, Master has said, one person living rooted in God's truth, in God's presence, does more good than all the well-meaning people and churchgoers in the world. So we're not doing this for ourselves alone. The search for truth is one person's victory is a victory for all humanity. You know, when Buddha, in that moment of enlightenment, as depicted in that beautiful poem, The Light of Asia, that moment when he achieved enlightenment, it said waves of blessing went out to the whole world, uplifting people and creating harmony and peace. And the antidote for what we see around us in the world today is to look for truth, to find truth, to be truth, to breathe truth, to share truth with the person in front of you in the grocery line, but just to pour out that truth. And then finally, so we have the motivators of suffering driving us to find happiness, of our innate soul wisdom pushing us to find truth. But then, and I think for most people, whether we like to admit it or not, the most powerful motivator is the search for love, to fill that emptiness in our heart. I read a quote that someone said, within each one of us, there is a God, with each one of our hearts, there is a God-shaped hole that only God can fill. Not things, not accomplishments, not success, not professional talent, but just God. Just God will fill that hole in our heart. And St. Augustine put it so beautifully. He said, Lord, thou hast made us for thyself alone, and our hearts are restless until they find their rest in thee. So that yearning for love, ultimate love, that's really the greatest motivator. And finally, the search for God takes us to the source of love. Not an object, not a person, not a beautiful community, but the source of love, which is the consciousness of God. And that is when the heart, the anxiety, the unease, the frustration and suffering, it all is answered in that moment where we feel the presence of God's unlimited love for us in a very, very personal way. And that's the beauty of it. God, yes, he's infinite. Yes, he's beyond it. But as someone said to Master, if God is infinite, how could he possibly care about us as individuals? What difference would we make in our infinitesimalness? And Master answered with such wisdom, such love. He said, your concept of infinity is too small. God is infinitely big, but he's infinitely small. And as it says in his poem, Samadhi, the sparrow, a grain of sand, falls not without his sight. So God, the greatest motivator is to be the yearning to fill that emptiness in our heart. And we can pretend, each one of us can pretend, hey, I'm okay, I'm fine, no problem here. Look, I got a new hairdo, I'm fine. But in our hearts, we know we're empty. And the only thing that can fill that is feeling the presence of God's love within us. And then finally, what keeps us going? Because I think if we all ask ourselves the question, am I satisfied with my personal search for God? I don't think any of us would say yes. Few of us. I wouldn't. But we need to remember that God is the doer. The effort we make draws the grace that keeps us going. We can't do it by ourselves. We do the best we can, and then God comes. They say if we reach one hand up to God, he reaches two down and pulls us forward. And just as when Swamiji was a young monk and he was doing everything he could, meditating and chanting and serving and everything, studying the teachings, and he felt his consciousness changing. And then word came back to him that Master had commented to some of the other brothers, look how I've changed, Walter. And so for all of us, maybe we're dissatisfied with our search for God, but we've all made some progress. Every one of us. How can we deny that? You would not be here if you hadn't taken some steps forward on the spiritual path. So let's open our hearts and eyes and minds to Master and try to listen to his words that say, look how I've changed you. I was the one who did it. And so the search for God, ultimately, we bring to God our love, we bring to God our yearning, we bring to God our desire to get out of suffering. But ultimately, God's the one who does it all. And what a great thing that is. Because how could any of us, as Swami says in his beautiful song, surely we, children of this world, could not love by our own powers, could not seek God by our own powers, could not find God by our own powers. And this is our destiny. And walking hand in hand with God and Guru, let us never give up the thought, in this lifetime, I will find.